This week, the Senate Standing Committee on Economics will be meeting to discuss their review on Australia's innovation system in light of the challenges to Australian industries and jobs posed by increased global competition in science, engineering, research and education. The final report isn't due until the first sitting day in July next year, but even so, are they looking at the wrong thing? Instead of innovation, should they be looking at invention? More and more, it seems, we hear people talking about innovation. Oh, that's very innovative, isn't it? Oh, yes, and it's spoken in positive terms. Innovation is a good thing. Well, our next guest, Ian Maxwell, might not be so positive about innovation, but he's very positive about invention. And he sees the need for a national invention system more than a need for us to be innovative. So joining me now is Ian Maxwell. Ian, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Amanda.
Well, you're not too keen on innovation. You're a bit harsh on it, maybe, do you think?
I was trying not to be harsh. I wrote an article recently which offended a few people, but that wasn't my intention. It was more just to try and bring some balance to the debate that's going on about innovation in the Australian environment, business environment particularly, and also in the university environment.
Sure. No, I think that's obviously that is a good thing. But maybe it's a little bit harsh to say that all the person needs to do is claim prior ignorance, and what they're talking about can be claimed as innovation. I genuinely don't think it's that easy to get something regarded as innovative. I'd always thought that innovation was best described as not new research or new knowledge, but a new application, a previously undiscovered application of existing knowledge.
I think that's one good definition, but I don't think everybody applies that. And one of the problems with innovation, there is no formal definition of innovation. Where there is, of invention, because there's a patent system which tries to capture invention.
Oh, so this is a word that once it's become popular and people think, well, that's a good thing, everyone says, oh, this is innovative, and they attach that word to their product or idea in order to encourage people to think that their product is good, whereas really there's no mechanism for deciding whether you're entitled to put that label innovative on your product or idea.
Well, it's not like organic food where there's some government-mandated use of the terminology. One of the real problems, of course, is there's a lot of government grants and schemes associated with innovation, and once there's money to be had,
People come.
People relabel whatever they're doing as innovative just to go and try and attract that money, as you know.
Yes, and we have a group of people, presumably predominantly in Canberra, deciding what is innovative and what is not, and that doesn't necessarily fit with the rest of the world's idea of depository of all knowledge about innovation, does it?
Look, I don't blame anybody in Canberra. I think they've got a pretty tough job. You've got a lot of people coming at them with very crafty plans, you know, built with the best marketing strategies to extract money off them. And it's very difficult sitting in Canberra. And I really applaud the public servants in general for the great job they do. I think the problem is more on the strategy around how these programs are built, not how they're implemented.
Mm. Well, look, congratulations. You're one of the few people that are happy to acknowledge the difficulties facing the Australian public service. I've said before, one of the great privileges of being a minister is, aside from the policy opportunities, if you like, that come, the great privilege of shaping the Lego bits of Australian society, a lesser but nonetheless great privilege is to work with senior public servants, and they do a fabulous job, and they have a difficult job. But you know, I can't let it go without saying these are the guys that design those systems, so they do have a tremendous impact on the strategy that's put in place. But look, well, that's not what we're talking about, is it? We're talking about innovation versus inventiveness. Now, you think inventiveness is much more important. Now, you've got a definition of it that has a number of requirements. Can you run us through those?
Yes, certainly. Like, there is two ways to look at invention. One is the formal definition under any patent system, and I must say that they are different around the world, how that's measured, but they're roughly the same. And the other is a more common usage of the word inventiveness.
Yeah.
The nice thing about having a patent system in place is that there is a very formal and legal definition of inventiveness. So if you have a pool of money to apply to the Australian economy, say from the government, it's something that's easily measured, and it's something that the outcomes can be easily measured as well. So before you know if your program's doing well.
Yes.
We do know that all the money that's been spent on innovation in Australia has not actually had any positive outcomes because our high-tech exports are slipping backwards at a rate of knots in terms of percentage of our exports.
Does innovation have to be high-tech, though?
I think there is innovation which is not high-tech, or the application doesn't appear to be high-tech. But in the modern era, if you apply IT technology to agriculture, at the end of the day, you're still buying a piece of meat. It doesn't look high-tech, but the benefit that's made it cheaper or better generally is high-tech in the modern era. So it's very rare to see low-tech innovation these days.
Fair enough.
So, but you did ask me a question which I sort of talked around, which was the definition of invention.
Yeah.
There's a number of ways of looking at it, but at a very high level, invention has to be novel, genuinely novel, not just novel to the person or the company or the place. Second thing, it has to be useful. That is useful to society, either from a social sense or from a business sense. Certainly, it has to be not obvious, and this is the least obvious part of the inventive definition, one that it has to be not obvious to somebody who's practiced in the arts. So it can't be, you know, oh, yeah, that's obvious. We knew that. That's not inventive. So there's a very high bar for obviousness in the patent system.
But in one sense, when you talk about what's obvious, a lot of things, once someone explains them to you, are obvious.
Very true.
But until someone thinks of it, to put, you know, one and one together and come up with two, it might not be that obvious. So what might seem to be obvious to everyone once it's been put together was perhaps not obvious at the time.
Exactly.
So how does after the fact someone decide that it wasn't obvious before?
Well, we have a whole patent system which has worked through that for over 100 years, so it's in place. How it works isn't all that obvious to a lot of people, to use that word again, but it does seem to work. There are criticisms of the patent system, but they are really at the edges of the system. It's in place, it's working. And they have a formal definition of obviousness, and they actually apply that when they're granting patents. And if patents ever get to court, the judge often reapplies that test to see if it stands.
Yes, okay. So that's it, that's the description.
Unfortunately, it is, yes. Okay. A lot of it's on precedent as well, so there's a lot of sort of case study where, you know, like any legal system where they apply precedent to these things.
Are they bound a bit by that? I don't mean legally bound, but with the precedents, do we end up having people who, in order to check about the inventiveness of something put before them as an invention, rely too much on records of the past as opposed to looking to the future?
I think there's a criticism that the bar for inventiveness has dropped somewhat in the patent system. So if there's any criticism, it's that patents are getting granted where other people think they shouldn't be granted. They're not inventive enough or novel enough or a bit too obvious. So in the US, for example, there's been a lot of software patents granted recently over the last 10 years, particularly in the internet space. And now the US is toughening up on that in light of some criticisms.
Sure.
You know, companies like Amazon, they patented one-click purchasing and then have enforced that patent. You know, that now won't be possible in the US.
I've got some friends that have recently got a patent, and I'm thinking now, you know, well, they're not a big company, they're a very small business. What are you going to do if someone steals it? How do you enforce patents?
Well, it's very difficult in Australia. I mean, the rate of patent enforcement in Australia is substantially lower than the US. And the reasons for that are that our judicial system, for some reason, seems to be pro-patent from a qualitative point of view. That is, it's very likely to uphold a granted patent and say that it actually is a valid patent. And they have the right to invalidate a patent, by the way. But the penalties for infringement are very, very low. And the penalties as a patent owner for doing what's called making unjustified threats against competitors are also very high. There was a case recently in Queensland in the federal court where a patent owner, simultaneously by the same judge in the same case, the patent that was being infringed was upheld as valid, but at the same time, the guy who owned the patents was found to be guilty of unjustified threats against the infringer. In exactly the same court, in exactly the same day. You know, we've got a problem, and people are scared to enforce their patents because of this issue of unjustified threats. And the costs of doing so are quite high, and the penalties for infringement are very low.
Yeah, well, the cost being high. Look, years ago in another incarnation, prior to the party I belonged to being government, I was on the Legal and Constitutional Affairs Committee with a lovely former Labor Senator, Barney Cooney. He's a terrific bloke. And we worked on committee inquiry called the Cost of Justice Inquiry. And it was a terrible experience, really, because you come to the stark realisation that probably the guy on the front bar of the pub could have told us and said, why'd you waste your money? That you can have all the rights you like, but if you haven't got the money to enforce them, they're not worth it. They're not worth the paper they're written on. You can't access your rights. It is a real problem. Well, what I mean there is not just for patent people, for all Australians. You know, someone can infringe your rights and you have to decide whether it's worth the money to pursue it. Anyway, I had a quick look at the blog that followed your article with some hesitation, frankly, because quite often you find that the blog comments after an article are just sort of the gutter of the internet, really. But I'm pleased to say that wasn't the case with your article. But I did see one fellow who said, look, hold on a minute. You can have all the patents you like. They're just an opportunity for commercialisation. If it doesn't happen, you've just got a whole lot of patents sitting around, a whole lot of inventive things that, well, I suppose what he's saying is, therefore, aren't very useful. So what can you tell us to help us understand, given they've got this test of usefulness, the number of patents that are there that have been commercialised? That's in one sense a way of saying, well, actually, they've got the test right, haven't they? Because they've said this is useful and look, someone has got it on the market and produced something.
Well, look, it's a fair comment. About roughly 90% of patents are worthless because for one reason or another, the ideas in them have never come to market.
Those... Well, what's for one reason or other mean? I mean,
there's a bunch of reasons. I can go through them.
Yeah, I'd love to know.
Sometimes the most obvious example is, you know, a backyard inventor, the classic Australian, you know, battler who's done something in his garage and doesn't have the financial means to go and commercialise the technology. All the ideas that they've had really aren't worth commercialising is another example, where, you know, somebody's invented a new drinking glass and they're in love with it and they've gone and patented it, but it's just not worth commercialising because it wouldn't be any financial return from the investment.
Then how did it pass the useful test?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, the Patent Office tries not to tell people that we don't need a new drinking glass.
Because, but telling the inventor that's not easy, I suppose.
No, and really it's tricky making those decisions because they might be wrong. And even if they're wrong one time in a thousand, you know, that's opening them up for all sorts of liability. So they can't really go and do that.
Okay, so they've got a usefulness test, but they're a bit shy on using it because of the consequences of saying no.
Yeah, well, we're not market experts. No. You know, I can't be an expert in every market where people are patenting. So obviously the useful test is the least, you know, strict of the lot.
Yeah. Although, see, the reason I'm pursuing this is you point out that our problem is a dire shortage of useful invention. That's your word. And I looked at it and thought, yes, this man's a very sensible man. He's right. Useful invention.
Yeah.
But the problem is, how do we work out what's useful or not? Do we simply leave it up to the market?
Well, you can. And obviously in the US, that's how it applies. But in Australia, we've got a very big problem. And that is that almost none of our large companies have patents or have many patents, and none of them are relying on patents as any part of their market strategy. So we're in a country with, you know, say, look at the top 20 listed companies. They've got about 3,000 Australian patents between them. 12 of them have got less than 20 patents. None of those patents are core to the businesses of those companies.
Yeah.
So if your large companies are not patenting and not getting involved in developing new technology in their main revenue streams, as a country, you really can't hope to be innovative or inventive or have a technology export sector. So that is the core of our problem, is that our large companies aren't involved in invention and or innovation, to be honest.
Yeah. So is that really the short form of your message to the Senate Economics Committee? What
yes,
do you want
it
to
is.
Say to them?
Yes, it is. There's no point really, you know, for trying to force universities into doing commercial stuff or getting small SMEs involved, if our large companies aren't also involved, right in the core of their activities. Because until that happens, you don't have a complete ecosystem, and those small companies and universities can't really thrive unless our big companies are active in the space.
And do you have an idea how they should go about it?
I think the best way to encourage large companies to get involved is to make some judicious changes to some of the tax incentives that we have. In the UK, for example, they've introduced what's called a patent box system, which gives companies, if they can demonstrate a relationship between some of their core patents and their main revenue stream, they can get an extra tax deduction on those revenues. So that's a big encouragement to innovate in the areas of their, you know, largest areas of their revenue stream.
It is indeed. Well, there's one idea. I hesitate to say it's a good idea because it's not my job to recommend policies to Senate committees or, for that matter, to the government. But congratulations on your article. And on not only just having some ideas about what ought to be done, but actually one idea at least about how to get there. Ian Maxwell, thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks, Amanda. Really enjoyed it.
Ian Maxwell is a technology entrepreneur and investor. He's also an adjunct professor at RMIT, and his article, What If We Had a National Invention System, was published in the conversation. You're on RN, and you're listening to Counterpoint with me, Amanda Vanstone.